Good evening. Thank you for joining us tonight. My name is Jake Wagner, and on behalf of the board of Cultivate Kansas City and the University of Missouri, Kansas City, I want to welcome you tonight to Unity Temple in this beautiful space and this beautiful event. I'd also like to thank all of our sponsors, our community partners, all of our staff, volunteers, everyone who is making this event happen tonight and throughout the weekend while Vandana is here with us. I'd also like to thank all of our financial sponsors, including Chipotle Mexican Grill, for making this possible. Cultivate Kansas City is a catalyst for the development of a sustainable regional food movement in Kansas City. We operate two working farms, one at Gibbs Road over in KCK, and one at Juniper Training Farm, also in Kansas City, Kansas, near downtown. That's right. Woo! It's here for the growers. Our job is to incubate local farms and local food, being a catalyst for the food movement here in Kansas City, connecting food citizens, eaters, folks like you, to growers throughout our region. And events like tonight's lecture are key to this larger movement of environmental justice. Dr. Vandana Shiva is a physicist, an ecologist, an activist, an author, and a beautiful person who's helping to change the way the world thinks about food and sustainability. She's a recognized global leader. She's a founder of Navdanya and the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Ecology, a participatory public interest research organization, which is really what our universities need to be about. Navdanya's work includes attention to climate change. And my colleague Molly Davies, who's here tonight, has worked hard to bring climate change education to UMKC through the Environmental Studies program. Thank you, Molly. Dr. Shiva is impacting the environmental movement around the world, and it is both a professional and personal honor to introduce her tonight to talk to you all about nonviolence, food sovereignty, and ecological sustainability. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Vandana Shiva.
Thank you very much. Thank you. It's a joy to be here with all of you. It's a joy to be here in a place where love is the altar. Because in the ultimate analysis, it is about love. About love for the planet, all the beings that are our Earth community, all of our fellow human beings in the remotest part of the planet. And Cultivate was about love and is becoming again about love. It is about bestowing attention, about care. It's derived from cultivare, which is about fostering and cherishing, about creating the culture of caring and honoring the earth and ourselves, about tending and guarding and nurturing. And the only way we can cultivate with that love is through diversity, because diversity is the web of life. For a short while, we've been made to believe that diversity is an obstruction to efficiency, because the mechanistic mind has projected onto the world the idea that growing of life in mutuality, in give and take, is nothing but an industrial activity. And I realized in 1984 when I started to study the Green Revolution, not because it was my chosen path. My chosen path was following the footsteps of Einstein, delving into the mysteries of nature, which is how I ended up studying quantum theory, and learning that we live in an interconnected world. It's not just ecology that teaches us that. Even quantum theory teaches us that. And a biology that tries to mimic physics should keep up with the physics. Working with a 100-year-old paradigm of fragmentation and mechanistic thought, of reductionism and separation, when none of that is true in the real world. And it wasn't a natural evolution. There was a cultivation of that worldview. And the worldview was cultivated by people like Bacon, Newton, Descartes. Bacon believed that you can only progress not by a gentle guidance of nature, but you have to have power over her to conquer her and subdue her. That is human progress, the conquest of man over the earth. And he called this the birth of masculine time. It was literally the title of one of his books. Institutions were born. Royal Society said it is the masculine aim of science to enable an empire of man over the earth. And Boyle, who was the governor of New England, said this confusion that Native Americans have, that the earth is somehow sacred and the veneration they have is discouraging and an impediment to the empire of man over inferior creatures of God. I think in this Unity Temple, that would be considered an error. And that worldview went on to shape a militarized mind, to put chemistry at the service of war. And every agrochemical input was literally the transformation of war chemicals into agrochemicals. The fertilizer factories used to be explosive factories. The early pesticides and nerve gases were created to kill people in the concentration camps. That's where the organophosphates began. We've always been told they were safe, even though those who brought them to agriculture and as tools for producing food knew they kill. In fact, they had shaped them as instruments of death. So in 1984, when the Bhopal disaster happened, I realized after my studies that it wasn't an accident. The pesticide plant owned by Union Carbide then, and now owned by Dow Chemicals, had leaked on the night of December the 2nd. 1984, 30 years ago, 3,000 people died immediately. 30,000 have died since then. And in the state of Punjab, which is the land of the five rivers, that's what Punjab means, some of the most fertile soils, and the five rivers with abundant irrigation. That is why that chemical revolution was taken to Punjab, sadly called the Green Revolution, neither green nor revolutionary. All kinds of stories were told. Every textbook everywhere in the world will tell you India was brought out of famine by the Green Revolution. We hadn't had a famine after we became free. The last big famine was the 1942 Great Bengal Famine during British rule. And the famine was not because there wasn't enough rice in Bengal, but half the rice was being taken away as taxes and to feed the armies during the war. 2 million people died, and it's the women of Bengal who came out. And now when I travel there for building Navdanya and our seed movement, in remote villages they will have murals with women standing in front of their harvested rice with a broom in their hands. And the other side are military men with guns. But the women said, Jaan debo dhan debo na. We will give our lives, we will not give our rice. And they blocked the appropriation. This led to the 1942 Quit India movement that Gandhi started and basically told the British to go home, that we can govern ourselves better. And we created a food system that got rid of famine, because famine was a result of exploitation. Amartya Sen has written about it. We created land reform, of putting land back in the hands of the tiller. We created a universal food system of affordable food for all. And we made food security the main objective of agriculture. So in 65, 66, when the Green Revolution was introduced, it wasn't that people were dying. We'd had a drought. Food prices had increased. Just as food prices have increased this year in the United States as a result of the drought. And I was just reading the USA Today. Once in a while they have a readable article. And it's talking about the sticker shock at grocery stores with 38% increase in prices of food, 58%, 56% in pork, and 49 million people in this rich, wealthy country, which is also supposed to be a democracy, not being able to exercise their right to food. 49 million. So the Green Revolution was introduced, and this slogan was created. India moved from a ship-to-mouth existence, that we were depending on shipments for everything. Now, that year, because of price rise, we needed to import. But we were told we had to introduce chemical agriculture, given this wonderful name of the Green Revolution. Why? Because they had been trying to introduce chemicals for 1.5 decades before that. But native seeds and native plants don't really like chemical fertilizers. I say they engage in a satyagraha, which is Gandhi's word of the force of truth. So with organic, they stand tall, they give you fodder, they give you straw, they give you fertilizer, and they give you enough grain to eat. More importantly, a native wheat will happily grow with chickpeas, with mustard, and per acre, that produces far more food and nutrition. Just as the systems that the Native Americans used, based on the three sisters of the corn and the squash and the beans, which in Mexico, the land of corn origins is called the Milpa system of togetherness. Diversity loves diversity because diversity is about life in its freedom and its cooperation. The corn grows, gives the support to the beans give the nitrogen. You don't need chemical fertilizers. But you pump nitrogen fertilizers, your crops start to lodge. That I call the plant satyagraha. And take these chemicals away. I want organic food. But the chemical push was the main reason for adapting the plants to the chemicals. And that is what the dwarf varieties were for. That's what Norman Borlaug got the Nobel Peace Prize for. And it's because of that Peace Prize, questions rose in my mind. I said, if this was supposed to be about peace through chemicals and seeds bred for chemicals, why have 30,000 people been killed in violence in Punjab? And that's what drove me to study it, only because as a scientist I can't be surrounded with unexplained phenomena which don't make sense. And Punjab and the Green Revolution didn't make sense to me. So I followed it. I was working for the United Nations University for a major program on the conflicts over resources. And that's how the book, The Violence of the Green Revolution, was written for the United Nations University. It's a book that suddenly started to get me invited to conferences on agriculture and biotechnology. By then I realized, the first thing, that diversity produces more. Monocultures are in fact highly impoverished. They're impoverished in diversity, but they're impoverished in food and nutrition. And the trick that makes this part of the world look like the food basket is because instead of measuring food and nutrition per acre, what's measured is the yield of commodities per acre. I can take a very diverse field, growing nine crops, and Navdhanya means nine seeds, nine crops growing together will not just produce more, they will have more resilience. They can never fail. A drought won't finish it off, a flood won't finish it off. One of the nine, two of the nine, five of the nine will still thrive. So never does a farmer with diversity have total failure. Because there's diversity and there's ecological functions, the pest control is built into the system. Soil fertility renewal is built into the system. Water conservation is built into the system. Every time we have a drought and I travel the country, I will be taken to farms where there's been a collapse of production. Those are Green Revolution farms waiting for rain because chemical agriculture needs 10 times more water. And then I'll be taken by our members to the farms which, in spite of no rain, still have a crop because the moisture in the soil through the organic matter is holding the water resources for the seed. Another thing I realized, besides this false productivity, was that actually industrial agriculture is a highly inefficient system. In no other sector could you have 10 times the input to produce one time, one-tenth of the output. 10 kilocalories is used. 10 kilocalories to produce 1 kilocalorie. Ecological systems will use 1 kilocalorie to give you 2 or 3 or 5, depending how intense your ecological processes are and how intense your biodiversity is. So what we need to evolve towards is intensification of ecological processes, not chemical inputs. Intensification of biodiversity, not monocultures. Intensification of love and care. Because at the end of the day, that's what makes a garden bloom. And we stand at a threshold where we can continue not just the paradigm of war, but using the instruments of war in our food production system, turning our farmlands into war zones, turning our food into a war against our bodies, or cultivating the land, cultivating biodiversity. And just look at the names. I was once invited to debate Monsanto, my very favorite company, as you know. I couldn't travel to Washington, but I did a video. But in the process, you know, I was asked how, you know, what would a partnership for agriculture look like? And I looked at the names of the chemicals used in farming. Quick kill, rampage, bullet, broad strike, gunshot, shotgun, pentagon, prowl, squadron, lightning, assert, revenge, revolver, roundup, total kill, trigger, vanguard. Is this about food? So at one level, all the debates of the world are unfolding right here in your state. At one end, you have a continuation of that war mentality. At the other end, you have Kansas City and cultivate Kansas City. And which system will shape the future will depend on how we shape food democracy. The erosion of democracy through the structures that are being shaped to continue this war against the planet, against our minds, our knowledge, our freedom, our health. The instruments are very new. Humanity has never used them. Neither materially, never before, have we genetically modified, through genetic engineering, the foods that we eat by putting genes that don't belong to that species into the crop. So a lot of times people will say, oh, it's just like ordinary breeding. And we've always modified. And I said, of course at that level, every one of you is a genetic modification version of your parents. You're not identical, you're not clones. But genetic modification actually was a word created down the line. It used to be called genetic engineering. And then people didn't want their food engineered. And so they said, let's call it genetic modification. Then they went further in the Convention on Biological Diversity to say, let's call it living modified. And then for years we faced, you know, living modified means that yogurt that you make, which has that little living bacteria that can turn a yogurt in, milk into a yogurt. And it's the bread, and it's the wine, and it's the beer, and it's everything your grandmother did. So it's totally safe. But the introduction of new genes creates new challenges. On the one side, it creates the challenge that it is the method used to start a new kind of ownership, the ownership over life itself. Now, so far, life has reproduced. Even a horse breeder will breed a horse, but the horse breeder doesn't own that next generation. Breeders have bred seed, but never before have they said, 20 years down the line, the seed will belong to us, and whatever you harvest, you pay us a royalty. Now, because of that book I wrote on the Green Revolution, I started to get invited to these conferences, and one of them was a biotechnology conference in 1987, before commercialization of genetic engineering. The old chemical industry was there, saying, we have to do genetic engineering. The tools had been evolved in universities, and university scientists had put a moratorium on themselves because they said, we don't understand the implications. We've learned how to move the genes, but we don't know the implications. And responsibility in science means understanding implications. But by then, the tools were being taken to Wall Street. New biotechnology firms started. The old chemical giants started to buy up these new biotechnology firms. They suddenly remodeled themselves as the life sciences industry. And at that conference, it wasn't a conference of small discussion, they said, we have to do genetic engineering because it's the only way to take patents on seed. And they said they were too small. They had to get bigger. And by the turn of the century, there'd be five of them controlling seed, food, health, because the same companies produce agrochemicals. Same companies are now controlling the seed, but now they are also the same companies that control the pharmaceuticals. And they said five of us will control it all. They also talked about how these laws for patenting would have to be globally imposed, which is how the WTO rules on intellectual property were shaped. And Monsanto's representative, James Enyart, at a conference in 1995 in Washington, said, we achieved something unprecedented. We defined a problem, wrote a law, took it to our government, which then took it to WTO and imposed it on the world. We were the patient, diagnostician, physician, all in one. And as patients, the disease they were suffering from was that farmers are saving seed. And the solution they offered was, now let's make it a crime. Let's make it an intellectual property crime. For farmers to save seeds, for farmers to exchange seeds. And that's what patents on seed ended up doing. That's the day I decided I would start saving seeds. I knew nothing about saving seeds. But I am convinced at the end of many years that when you love anything, a subject, a plant, a child, the knowledge comes with that love. And today, we built up Navdanya, started 110 community seed banks, where farmers can go in a drought and get drought-tolerant seeds, go after a cyclone and get salt-tolerant seeds, as they did after the Orissa cyclones, and then the Orissa farmers gave 2 truckloads of salt-tolerant seeds to the farmers of Chennai and Tamil Nadu because of the tsunami in 2004. The government had thrown up its hands and said, the water has come so far in and there's salt all over. It will take 5 years for the salt to wash away. And I said, no, we'll get you the seeds. The farmers can cultivate right away in this year. And they did, and it did so well. Now, climate change is the context in which we have to cultivate today. And climate change means that climate resilient seeds must be available to farmers. Our patent office rejected recently, a few months ago, a patent application by Monsanto for a very wide climate resilient patent on traits in all crops. The chemical companies who are now the biotechnology companies have taken 1,500 patents on climate resilience. Some of the patents cover 50 plant species. For everything, cold stress, heat stress, drought stress, flood stress, soil tolerance, everything. That's not how breeding is done. But they're not breeding anyway, they're gambling. Because earlier, what they would do is just take a patent on knowledge they found. And that is why I had to fight cases of biopiracy. Biopiracy is the name we've given to the patenting of indigenous biodiversity and the knowledge associated with it. My grandmother used to use neem for our clothes, our silks, our woolens, and the wheat and the rice. We knew it's a pest control agent. And a company called Grace patented its use for pest control. I fought that case for 11 years. Because before that, I had started the movement for no more Bhopals, let's plant a neem. We don't need these toxics in our food. We have brilliant gifts like the neem tree. 11 years later, that patent was struck down. And since I am in the States, I might as well mention the patent was jointly held by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and this company called W.R. Grace, which, for those of you who will remember, was the subject of a film called A Civil Action. They were injecting toxics into the groundwater, and it was the mothers of the children who were getting leukemia who started the investigation. Why were their kids getting cancer? So Grace and USDA, and I'm sitting in the patent office, in the European patent office. We tried to make a challenge in the US too, and they asked us, and we had collected 100,000 signatures, and we went to the U.S. patent office and we went to the European patent office, where in both places the patent had been granted. In the U.S. they said, so what's your commercial interest? We said, we don't have a commercial interest. We have a public interest for the common good. Sorry, we don't entertain challenges in the public interest. You just have to be a competitor. In Europe, they have public interest clauses, and our challenge was accepted, and I'm sitting in the hearing with scientists from India, farmers from India who've been using neem to establish prior art, and the lawyer who's representing both the U.S. government and Grace turns around and says to the judge, she can't be, they always call me she, you know, she can't be here because she is not a European. So I smiled and said, but Your Honor, neither are they. And it was on 8th of March, Women's Day in 2005, finally, that patent was struck down as piracy. And then I find in 98, the basmati for which my valley, Dehradun, is famous, was patented by a Texas company called Rice Tech. And there's this amazing idea that you just put tech against something and everyone will accept it. So they said, Rice Tech, inventors of basmati, the height of the plant, the length of the grain, even the aroma. Basmati means the queen of aroma. They sell it as Texmati, which means the queen of Texas. It took a lot. I had to file cases in the Indian Supreme Court to get the government to act, but I also did movements, and the movement in this country was churches from Texas sending postcards to the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office saying, if you don't strike down this patent, we will have to call you the U.S. Piracy and Theft Office. They stuck most of the clauses down. And I noticed as I entered, there's a little restaurant down here which says gluten-free. And part of the reason so many people have gluten allergies is because of the way wheat has been bred. We still have wheats that don't contribute to allergies. We have gluten-free wheat. So, Monsanto says one in three Americans have gluten allergy. Let's patent the Indian wheat. We challenge that one too. Couldn't get it. Now, the recent patent on climate resilience was struck down in India because we were forced, because of the WTO intellectual property agreement, to change our laws, which said nothing in agriculture can be patented. But we had built up movements. We worked with our parliament, and the parliament put in a clause which says, it's 3J of our patent law, plants and animals in whole or in part thereof, including seed varieties and species and essentially biological processes for production and propagation of plants and animals, cannot be patented. On 5th of July 2013, Monsanto's climate resilient patent was rejected. But of course, it's never over. Now there's a National Association of Manufacturers, 50 U.S. business groups. They just keep forming groups. And they're threatening India for India to become a priority foreign country. Now, you would imagine priority foreign country means US and India will love each other so much as I love you. No, it's about targeting India for trade sanctions. And all we've done is say what is not an invention. And our parliament, our courts have said a seed giving rise to seed is a biological process. It's not your invention. You can, at best, move a gene, but gene shufflers are not creators of life. Otherwise, I remember seeing these trucks called U-Haul. At the end of it, U-Haul would be the owner of every building into which it moves the furniture. You could say, I brought the furniture, therefore I made this, therefore I'm the owner, therefore they'll tell the owner, now you pay me a rent. And that's the absurdity that has been established. To establish man's empire over the earth through genetic engineering. My challenge to the corporations pushing GMOs is, you give up the patents, and let's see how far you'll go. But in any case, there is an ontological schizophrenia out there, because on the one hand, when it comes to owning a GMO, they say, my invention never existed in nature before. GMO means God move over. You have nothing to do with creation. And then eaters want to know, are there GMOs in my food? Can I have labeling? Can we have more research on safety? They say, no, we don't need research. Because we have assumed this is just like nature made it. And the principle, a highly unscientific principle, was turned into a policy of this country denying American citizens the right to know. Because in the Convention on Biological Diversity in 1992, we managed to put in a clause 19.3, which talked about biosafety, a new safety in the context of GMOs. You have had air safety and Clean Air Acts because of the pollution of the air. We've had Water Safety and Clean Water Acts. Biosafety is to have the protection of biodiversity in the context of the new kind of pollution called genetic pollution. And the fact that genes will move, you've changed the gene, now it will move through pollination, and it did. The two cases. One is Percy Smizer, a Canadian farmer, whose canola crop was contaminated by Monsanto's Roundup Ready canola. And Monsanto came to him and said, you've stolen our genes, you pay us $200,000. He said, if your genes are in my crop, then you polluted my crop. And the normal law is the polluter gets paid. And anyway, how did you get into my farm? That's trespass. The lower courts ruled property in land is a lower level of property than intellectual property. And they also ruled that it doesn't matter how the genes came to be there. It could be through the wind or pollinators, but it will be counted as intellectual property theft. Case went all the way to the Canadian Supreme Court, and we organized around the world and intervened. The fine was struck down. But a law that says a gene is patentable means the plant in which the gene is patentable, means the future generations of that plant are still property. And this happened with a farmer called Bauman in this country, the Bauman versus Monsanto case. Our courts rejected a Monsanto patent. Supreme Court of this country upheld a patent where a farmer had bought grain, soybean, in an elevator and planted it. And Monsanto challenged him. And the Supreme Court struck down Bauman's case. And basically is saying the opposite of what the Indian courts are saying. The Supreme Court of the US is saying that by changing one gene, Monsanto owns future generations, not just of the seed they sell, but the grain the farmer grows. This is violative of every principle of science, law, ethics. And that's why I took the pledge when I started Navdanya to not only not accept it, but to build the movements that would allow people to see sanity. And we fought for seed freedom, and I'm very happy to say in India we have prevented every law that would take away our freedom. We prevented a law that would criminalize farmers' varieties. We put in to our plant variety legislation a farmer's right clause, that a farmer's right to save, exchange, improve, breed, sell seed can never be taken away. And I hope the movements of this country will make seed freedom a fundamental right. At no point do regimes create justice. People do. Apartheid would still be around if there hadn't been anti-apartheid movements. Gandhi led the first anti-apartheid movement when they were starting to put in place the laws of racial segregation. They were required to wear badges to say, I'm an Indian, I'm a white, I'm a black. And he said, we are one citizenry. People forget he was in South Africa for a very long time. And it was another 9/11, 1906. He led a satyagraha, and he used the name satyagraha the first time, the force of truth. He says, we are one citizenry, we will not obey a law that divides us. And he also wrote that any unjust law and brutal law, if it's obeyed, will create dictatorship and slavery. So it is our duty as human beings to stand up. That is how you had a civil rights movement. Rosa Parks said, no, we are equals. I can sit on this seat also. Every movement for human freedom has needed people to have the courage to work for higher law, the law that comes from our being part of this amazing universe and this amazing planet. Those are Gaia's laws, the laws of the earth. And every country, each of our countries, has shaped constitutions that made people equal. And if they didn't, then those constitutions changed. The women who weren't given the right to vote got the right to vote. That is the basis of where we are working from. And I think the patenting of seed is the single biggest violation of the rights of the earth and rights of human beings. Because not only does it violate the rights of farmers, it violates the rights of eaters. In terms of the rights of farmers, the only crop that is genetically modified in India so far is the GMO BT cotton. Half the price of the seed that our farmers are paying today comes as royalty to Monsanto. This is not my claim, it's the evidence given by Monsanto to our parliament during a big hearing that the parliament organized on the suicides of farmers and the issue of GMOs. And then concluded GMOs have no place in a society of small peasants where 65% of the Indian people live on the land, 80% of our holdings are less than 2 hectares. We're a land of small farmers. We are an agrarian society. Now, when a small farmer with small amount of land is brought advertisements with our gods, Hanumanji, Guru Nanak Dev, every god, and we have so many in India. You know, we have 300 million species on the planet. India was smart enough to say 300 million gods. And you know, the fact that we do namaste, basically it is, I bow to the divine in you. There are 1,200 divinities in this temple. So when that's used first, the peasant says, yeah, must be. Hanumanji is bringing me these miracle seeds. There's also a phenomenon called seed replacement, where the companies will say, we'll give you money. Give up your old seed. It's primitive. But the farmer thinks his aunt in the next village has it anyway, so. But doesn't realize his aunt has been made to give up the seed too. So farmer seeds go. Interestingly, public systems just go to sleep. No public breeding. Not one variety released since Monsanto came in. And Monsanto then buys up or locks into licensing arrangements all the Indian seed companies selling cotton seed. 60 companies. We did a survey on the growing concentration of the seed sector. Yeah. The seed price jumped 8,000%. Of course, everyone says the fact that 95% of the cotton seed in India is now BT cotton means farmers are choosing. Farmers aren't choosing. The choice is gone. Now, remember, at a meeting on WTO in agriculture, there were farmers from the Midwest, and there was an Iowa farmer. And I asked him, I said, why are U.S. farmers growing GMO cotton? He says, the companies have a noose around our neck. We are not choosing. That's all they're giving us. Because why would they sell open pollinated seeds the farmer can save? When a GMO seed means the farmer can't save it, that's where the profits are. That's why corn and soya has taken over. It's not because people are saying, give me GM corn, give me GM soya. Because that's where the royalties come. And that's why 85% of your food has these ingredients. And then when people want to know what they're eating, and the Californians try, and the people in Washington try, and 24 states are trying to have labeling laws, then you get this new amazing proposal from Mr. Butterfield and Mr. Pompeo, and if I'm pronouncing his name wrong, Mr. Pompeo, I apologize. I'm an Indian. The act is called the Safe and Accurate Food Labeling Act. It is meant to block those 25 states having their laws. It is meant to give voluntary labeling options to the companies and not make it mandatory. Worse, since this evening is co-sponsored by Chipotle, companies like Chipotle, companies like Whole Foods that want to go GMO-free, which are now going for the non-GMO label, will not be allowed to put that label because that federal law will prevent it. Movements here have called it the Dark Act, denying Americans the right to know act. Mr. Pombo said, GMOs have made food safe and more abundant. It has been an enormous boon to all of humanity. Now, I would like to take Mr. Pombo to Vidarbha, which is the capital of BT cotton, but it is also the capital of farmer suicides. In the year 2001, before commercial sales were allowed, the suicides were 52. By then, hybrids had started. The control over the seed had already taken place. But there were 52. Jumped to 104 in 2002. By 2006, it was 1,148. 2008, 1,248. We are talking, and that's the graph. In the area where BT cotton is planted, the reason it's gone down here is because of our movements, our government was forced to give a debt relief package to the peasants. But that wore out and they're picking up again. Those 284,000 farmers at the national level since 1995 would not say GMOs have been a boon to humanity or seed monopolies have been a boon to humanity. The bill has been crafted not by Mr. Butterfield in Pompeii. We don't have this phenomenon in India because, you know, lobbying is illegal. That's interesting, you know. We don't have a Mr. Cox. And in fact, there was an issue once about Monsanto's they try to call it education of the politicians. There's a big parliamentary hearing about whether even that is legitimate. But it's basically this association, grocery manufacturers association. In my view, grocery is that little shop next door to you. Yeah? You go buy your dal atta, buy your daily groceries. Now, groceries manufacturers association is the Cokes and the Pepsis and all of the big players, and the biotech industry joins them. And they call their coalition the Coalition for Safe and Affordable Food. It's not safe. And normally, what are done in studies are statistical correlations. And all statistical correlations are now showing in this country an absolute exponential increase in major diseases. Cancers, all kinds, deaths due to intestinal infection have gone up sixfold since the time of increase of glyphosate use and the Roundup Ready crops. The Center for Disease Control put out data just the other day that autism used to be 1 in 88 children. It is now 1 in 68. 30% jump. And with this kind of increase, the projections are every second child of this country will be autistic. Now, I believe a government owes it to its people to understand the science of what are the factors leading to increase these diseases. The Center for Disease Control has admitted it can't be genetic, it has to be in the environment. But they're not, of course, going further in it. Obesity. 2010, it was affecting 36% of adults. The diabetes associated with it, globally, still 3.4 million. 8.2 million have died of cancer. And each cancer is becoming an epidemic. The direct and indirect cost of obesity is $117 billion. Many of these are related to the combination of pesticides that are sprayed from outside and the pesticides that are now built into the plants through genetic engineering. BT is a pesticide produced in every cell of the plant. Herbicide-tolerant genes are a pesticide. We should be calling them pesticide-producing plants so that people understand, A, that it's a continuity of that poison road, which is also the road of war, and two, that they actually do contain toxins. As more and more data, and it doesn't come from the U.S. because the scientists aren't allowed to do these studies. Substantial equivalence says it's all fine, it's natural, you don't have to look, you don't have to see, and the fact that there's total ignorance about the harm, you can say there's proof of safety. But ignorance of harm is not proof of safety, it's ignorance. And a very important aspect of food democracy is knowledge democracy. I chair a commission on the future of food, which brought out manifestos on seed, on food, on climate change, as well as on knowledge, because we are realizing there's a deep closure of knowledge taking place. Let me give you one simple example. So we know there's climate change happening. It's not a normal phenomenon, it's not a natural phenomenon. 40% greenhouse gases come from industrial globalized agriculture. A major contributor is nitrogen of fertilizers, contributing to nitrogen oxides, 300 times more deadly than carbon dioxide, as well as methane. There's a new map I just saw on this area of the Midwest with absolute red zone in terms of the emissions of greenhouse gases. So 40% comes from the system, and of course these companies are getting ready to deal with it. As I mentioned, Monsanto's taking patents on climate-resilient crops. What they're doing now is putting you go to a gene bank, and these seeds are available in the public domain. You collect all the drought-tolerant varieties. So you know they're drought-tolerant. Then you put them through a computer reading. And you try and figure out what is the common part of the genome. And as they write, we try and make a guess using a software program. They're not breeding. We try and make a guess what could be the winning ticket. 100, we bet on 100. Wall Street collapsed because of betting on people's money. Agriculture could collapse if it's reduced to betting on what's a winner. All you need to do is go talk to the farmer and let the seed be in farmers' hands as a commons. Now Monsanto recently bought up a company called Climate Corporation for $1 billion. And basically, they would have control over climate data. You'd have to ring them up to know if a flood is coming. You pay a royalty there. Then you get the seed, you pay a royalty again. And if you don't pay that royalty, you don't get that information. I believe the atmosphere is a commons, and knowledge about where the weather is going is a commons too. I realize I think I have to do a study on Washington at some point. Because you even had a proposal called National Weather Service Duties Act in 2005 by someone called Rick Santorum. And he was basically trying to prevent the government from releasing weather bulletins. So we'd have to go to the companies to say, can you tell me if it'll freeze tomorrow? Will there be a flood? Will there be a snowstorm? It's an amazing idea of total control. And it needs a food democracy movement and an earth democracy movement to reclaim our rights. Well, coming to the second part of the safe and affordable food, affordable. Is it affordable? Not for the 49 million hungry, not for half of the Indians starving, not for half the children in India who are not getting food. But look at FAO's data in a recent report where they've calculated that 1 trillion is lost because of food waste, because these long distance chains and chains based on uniformity will lead to waste. Then they've added very indicative figures, 700 million billion for 172 billion on wasted water. It's an underestimation. Cleared forest, 429 billion in greenhouse gases. 150 billion in health costs due to pesticides. They haven't added the health costs, the cancers, the autism, the obesity. They've said 250 billion in loss of livelihoods. Again, that's a total underestimation. I know the UNEP has done a study. 159 billion is the contribution that pollinators make to our food system. 75% of them have been killed by a combination of the pesticide-producing GMO plants and pesticides themselves. So it's not affordable if you take the real cost of industrial food and genetically modified food. And I think we need to do much more work on the real costs. We also need to add to this the $400 billion subsidy, which makes costly food that's toxic for our health look cheap. It's not cheap. Our tax money is being used to deny us the right to safe food and commit the poor into the deadly diets that are not just not giving them food, but pushing them into diseases. They carry the worst burden in this country of obesity and diabetes. But it's not food either. It's not just not safe. It's not just not affordable. It's not food. When food becomes a commodity, it loses the quality of food. The quality of nourishment, the quality of nutrition, the quality of taste, the quality of care, the quality of cultivare. In any case, 90% of the corn and soya is going to drive cars and torture animals. I don't call it animal feed because the animals don't think it's food either. If they could do a satyagraha, they would say, give me grass. They're not called herbivores for nothing. Herbivores means they like grass. So even if they were to grow more GM corn and soya, it's not going to go to feed people. Overall, according to the United Nations, 70% of the food is being grown on small farms and they haven't counted the gardens. I would imagine that if you add all the gardens that are now coming up, like here in Kansas City, we would be at something like 80% or more. And that food is real food. It's not just a number. So 30% of the food is coming from industrial agriculture, which has destroyed 75% biodiversity, 75% water, 75% of the soils, and 40% of the contribution to greenhouse gases. It is the single biggest contributor to non-sustainability and ecological threats to the planet. 1 billion people are hungry, 2 billion are suffering from diseases related to food, and all the toxic related diseases, we could say 75% of the health burden comes from the industrial agriculture system. All that just to produce 30%? Now, if you imagine that all the bullying on the basis of which the expansion of industrial agriculture is based, it carries on. Let's assume they go from 30% to 50%, 60%. Will there be a planet left for living? No. It'll be 100% destruction. No soil, no seed, no biodiversity, no water, no climate. That project is a project of planetary suicide for our species. And that is why we need to cultivate diversity, cultivate freedom, cultivate hope. When I started Navdani, it was just for the pure love of the seed and its freedom to evolve into the future. Without genetic engineering, without patenting, just to have freedom of life on this planet. Today, having saved the seeds, created the seed banks, trained farmers to do ecological agriculture, because they were made to forget. And forgetting can be very fast. And then building the direct relationships between those who eat and those who produce the food. We realize that biodiverse systems actually produce much more. And we don't measure yield per acre. We measure nutrition per acre. We measure health per acre. And we are now measuring the real wealth per acre. Wealth is derived from well-being. The state of well-being. It never meant money. Aristotle said, oikonomia is the art of living. Krematistics is the art of money-making. It was always looked down on. Now, the art of money-making can reach the next step by patenting the seed, owning the weather data, new tricks all the time. But the art of living requires cultivation. And the art of living is being practiced across the world, where hope is being cultivated for the bees and the butterflies, for soil organisms, for the climate. But the two aspects that are really having me very inspired. For example, when I went to Juniper Farm today, or when I go to areas where young people have returned to the land from the slums, said, this looks like an agriculture I could actually be engaged in. And they're earning 10 times more than if they follow the industrial path or the GMO path. I think the two big shifts we need to make are, first, stop allowing labor. First, stopping to allow human creative work to be defined as labor as a commodity, and then to define labor as an input into a food system. Now, labor is not an input into a farming system. Creative work is an output of a good, healthy, sustainable farming system. And we will have to go that way. And the work that Juniper Farm is doing of cultivating hope for the people who have recently migrated to this country, that's the model. That's the model of rejuvenating dying cities, using every bit of land to cultivate. Cities have to become growers of food, not abandoned places. And just as creative work is an output, health is an output. It can't be a forgotten indicator. And we can't have it in another box where the more people who get cancer and the more people who get intestinal diseases and the more people who get autism, we say, wow, growth. Because more disease, the more the money, and then there's growth. Healthy people don't make GDP rise. Sick people contribute to rising GDP. And we come back to the fact that care for the planet, care for people, has to be the guiding force for how we produce our food, how we process our food, how we distribute it. Now, we've had a deep confusion about what is creation. I mean, Monsanto's under this crazy confusion that they are creating life on Earth. But there's also another confusion that thinks that nature is dead and people are unintelligent. No, nature is highly intelligent. And people's intelligence hasn't even begun to be unleashed to shape another future of food, to cultivate compassion and love, to cultivate abundance rather than disease, scarcity, hunger, fear. Food democracy is what we need to cultivate. And I carry joy in my heart because I know food democracy will be nourished by each one of you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Yes, we're going to do question and answer. I feel like I would like to get a bunch of pots of tea and sit down and just talk with you all night long. We are now going to do a question and answer session. You all should have gotten, as you came in, cards to write your questions on, and there are people who are going to be going around and collecting them. So please, if you have them, wave them up and somebody will get them from you. They're holding up their hands. And I would like to start with the question while that's happening. Earlier today, when you were talking about having to leave a meeting with a Monsanto representative to go do a farmer training, and I love that breadth, that you're going from policy down to working with farmers.
Up to working with farmers.
That's much better.
Down to policy and out.
Yes. Could you share with us a little bit about how you work with farmers?
Well, I started to save seeds by going back to the areas where I had worked with communities on movements like Chipko, where women came out to say, we'll hug the trees and you can't cut them without having to kill us. And that was the 70s. So I knew people in the villages. And I'd go with these books that my parents had of old agriculture books. Say, do you grow this? Do you grow this? Do you grow this? The way we build Navdanya is really allowing communities to decide how they want to run the seed saving. If they want to run it as a network or they want to run it as a physical place. The training we built up because it was so clear that so many places they've totally forgotten how to do ecological agriculture, even though India is the land from where organic farming spread worldwide in contemporary times. Albert Howard was sent to India to improve Indian agriculture with chemicals, and he saw there were no pests in the field. So I decided to make the pest and the peasant my teachers. He wrote a book called The Agricultural Testament. That is the basis of the Rodale Institute starting in this country, Soil Association starting in the UK. He was humble enough to know that nature is the best teacher. Peasants have a lot of knowledge. And we've built our training center, which I call the Earth University. Why can't the land and the earth be a teacher in these times? And every year now, we do a one-month course on the A to Z of ecological agriculture for living soil, living seed, living food, and living democracies. Because we've been told soil is dead, just a container into which you put NPK. The seed is just a mine for pulling out a few genes and taking a patent. There are nothing like relationships of beneficial insects. Every insect is trying to get you, and that's why you have to have a war against the pest and use the most lethal pesticide. No. Understanding the web of life by participating in it is the education we all need. So that's why I'm so glad Kansas City has these learning centers and the farms, and we do the same. Increasingly, it is farmers who are coming to us. Earlier, I used to trudge to the villages and try and tell them poisons weren't good for them and they were making them lose. But it's wonderful. And I feel as the crisis grows and as people make more connections between the ecological crisis, the health crisis, the economic crisis, then the path of cultivating diversity as freedom and prosperity will become more evident to more people.
I'm going to go through some of the questions. I think we're going to get a lot, so we're not going to be able to get to all of them. I hear you say seed diversity is of most concern. You also expand on soil health, composting, biochar. Thank you for your work for Gaia.
On the issue of seed diversity, it's a technical mindset that defines local seeds as static and low-yielding. But seed is just a potential. And living seed from that land has the highest potential to adapt and evolve. So we've grafted a law of the seed with the top biologists, breeders of the world, and lawyers. The law of the seed is diversity. That's how nature works. That's how farmers work. It is quality. No farmer has bred a fruit that is like a rock just because it has to sit for months on ships and containers. And no farmer has bred a non-nutritious, non-food because they're feeding their families. So quality, nutrition, taste. And the third is resilience. Resilience means the continuous ability to evolve and adapt. The engineered seeds or the chemically bred seeds of Dr. Borlaug have zero adaptation capacity. They're designed for that much water, that much chemical input, that kind of climate. Minute there's a change, it's zero. So in terms of soil fertility, in a way, the seed makes the soil because it's what you give back to the soil that makes the fertility, and then the soil makes the seed. It's a beautiful cycle of renewal. Composting, we have more than 32 kinds of composting. And Prince Charles was visiting our farm the other day, and he couldn't believe it. He said, you do so much with the cow dung and the cow urine? Well, I just said, that's why we call her the sacred cow. On biochar, if it's done by farmers, it's a different matter. But a lot of industry, including the biofuel industry, is trying to recycle pollution and waste as biochar. I think the soil has all the elements, the micronutrients, the taste elements, all of that. Soil is not just carbon. I don't think we should go the track of carbon reductionism as a solution to climate change. Living soils are the response to climate change because of their adaptability. Soils will need moisture conservation. Soils will need all the nutrients. The micronutrient deficiencies are such a big part of the disease. I had doctors visit me from Australia. Zinc deficiency is leading to 50% youth of Australia going into depression. We haven't even begun to understand the workings of this amazing human body. But when we work with diversity, diversity takes care of our health. When we try and engineer a golden rice, a vitamin A, a GM banana, reductionism of any kind will go against the laws of nature and Gaia and the laws of our bodies.
Could you talk about the differences between food democracy and food sovereignty?
Well, there's really no difference. It's just the spelling. Even my colleagues can't say or type sovereignty. They get it wrong all the time. And to make their lives simpler, I just said, okay, just use democracy. It means the same thing. It basically means self-organized freedom over your food, what you grow, what you eat, how you grow, how you distribute it. That's what it is. I really believe in, we have a lovely word for sarvata, the simple way. The simple way is what reaches people. We can create all kinds of complicated structures. But and I think the challenge is so deep that our responses must be quick. They mustn't be deliberate, but they still must be quick. And simply we can be without any falsehood in it. Simplicity, in fact, carries the best truth. That's the lesson I learned from Einstein. Simplicity is the highest level of elegance in communication.
East State University, other universities and biotechnology companies are genetically engineering wheat for release in the next decades. What can a land-raised wheat grower do to protect her or his seed from patent infringement?
Okay. What we did for this issue was first and foremost just save every bit of seed as possible and then distribute it widely. That's the best protection. Fortunately, rice is not as cross-pollinated as corn is. So the second thing is we need to have zones which are GMO-free. This next stage of creating food democracy will only work through community. The last stage, because yeah, I'll be an organic farmer, one lonely farmer in a huge region. I'll be one organic eater, let everyone eat poison. That period is over. Good food, safe food, protection of indigenous varieties can only happen as a community. That's why the challenge of cultivating diversity is cultivating community.
This is a good one for our area. How do we move corn and soybean farmers toward and back to farm diversity?
Yes. And the first is to let them experience the joy of diversity. Bring them to your learning centers. And then when they say our farms are too big, we need to create innovative methods of sharing. Why are farmers shifting to more spraying of Roundup? Because they've lost people on the farm. I remember going to head an ad, Bangalore. Women with green saying, liberate yourself, use Roundup. Now, the farmers of the Midwest, the farms have become so big that human beings are getting more replaced by fossil fuels, energy slaves, and toxics. But just as in the city, I realized, I haven't been here long enough, but I did realize you have a system of food banks or land banks where the abandoned plots are accessible to people at low cost. I know in France, Canada, large parts of Europe, young unemployed youth want to do farming are working with farmers who are either getting old or have land they can't manage. Those are new cooperative arrangements we will have to innovate with. I have a dream that all the unemployment benefits, there should be an option for young people to cultivate, which would mean that they're working as doctors because they're providing health. They're, of course, working as environmentalists because they're healing the earth. But they're also engaging in fruitful, creative work for the community. We have to shift our thinking about agriculture and food production as something that's of the past. And I've had these debates where some of the people who married to genetic engineering say, but Dr. Shiva, we are going to eat pills. Forget food, forget soil, forget seed. No, no, there will be no farmers in the future. And I say, okay, let's have a vote in the hall. How many of you want to live on pills? Nobody puts up their hand. If you're condemned to it, you'll do it. But you want real food. So I really believe that new partnerships between young people and the farmers, so that the farmers feel that the problem they have of being alone and being reduced to a caterpillar machine driver, that's all. Everything will come from the skies. The satellite will tell them, move here, move there. The robot will say, spray this poison, fertilize this land. For them to connect back to the earth, but to join it with community. And that's where I said, we haven't even started to use our intelligence fully. I work with the government of Rome, where jobs disappeared in 2010 in Italy. And they kept saying, how do we connect the work you do to the issue of unemployment? I said, let's start putting young people on the land. And they have passed a law, the city of Rome has passed a law to make public land available for groups of young people who could protect biodiversity, grow organic food, and create new food systems.
You have been quoted as saying, we are either going to have a future where women lead the way to make peace with the earth, or we are not going to have a future at all. Would you please elaborate on that?
Okay. Gandhi used to say a daily prayer, Mujhe aur istri mein banao. He was saying, make me more womanly. And for him, it was clearly about the values that have survived better in women. It's not about our genes. It's not about essentialism. It's about the fact that when the grand work was defined, we were told caring for children isn't work. But caring and cultivare is the most important work for our times. So when I say women will lead the way, it is because they were left to look after that which the patriarchal capitalist system felt was not necessary. Because they reduced everything to where can you make for more money. The reality is we have to find the places where we can protect and defend life more. As I've said, when it comes to life, the currency is not money, it's life itself. And that's where care, compassion, sharing, the ability to do all that. And Gandhi said, make me more womanly. And for him, as an apostle of compassion and nonviolence, those were the values. And if he could say that, then everyone can say that.
What can one individual do? I feel helpless against the huge corporations.
Don't look at the huge corporations. Except then they come and block what you want to do. That time become a satyagrahi. I notice not only do you have this Safe Food Act and Accurate Labeling Act, you also have a crazy Food Safety Modernization Act. It says if your animals are grazing, they're feral. If you're making cheese at home, dangerous. If you have chicken in your backyard and you're slaughtering it without contaminating it with a factory farm, that's ugly. And there's a book that a farmer from this country sent me,
Joel, that was it?
Joel Salatin.
And the title is Everything I Do is Illegal. Now, when they... That's the time you have to sort of deal with the corporation. The rest of the time, love the seed, love the soil, love your neighbors, and do everything that's needed to take care of them. And in the process, you'll be taken care of.
I think that's a good one to end on. It's 8:30, and I am so sorry for all these questions and comments and expressions that we can't get through tonight. She's at the end of a long tour and has been working hard while she's here, and we've got her booked for tomorrow as well, so I don't want to overtax you. I want to say that for all of the hard stuff that she talked about, I feel very much like where there is something happening at this particular point in history, at this particular time of life in Kansas City, in our region, in the world. And I feel like we are opening up to changing our course, the course we've been heading down for the last 50, 60 years. I feel like we are at a place where, in fact, we can make change. And the people in this room, every single one of you, important and essential to that. And I think we brought Vandana here partly because she has this way, it seems, of inspiring and challenging people to think more broadly, to think in a deeper, more connected, and to gain courage from that broader vision. And so I hope that each of you go away today with more courage, with more chutzpah, with more sense of, I can go out and take something as small as a seed, and I can change the world. So thank you all for coming.